This is the AdNonTech Podcast, conversations about education, technology, and culture, with Dr. Doug Reed and Dr. Matt Stranick. Thank you for joining us.
My name is Dr. Doug Reed, and I am located in Abigwe, the traditional and unceded territory of the Mi'kmaq people.
My name is Dr. Matthew Stranick, and I am located in Manakwisk in St. John, New Brunswick, which is situated on the traditional and unceded territory of the Wolastoqiyik Maliseet people. Welcome to the latest edition of the AdNonTech Show. We're joined, as ever, myself, Matt Stranick, and Dr. Doug Reed, inestimably. We're on about something that's rather different from our last regular episode. I'm kind of curious about it. It's going to be interesting to me, I dare say, because, full disclosure, folks, I'm only experiencing the notes for the first time right now. So, that'll be interesting for all of us, especially me. How's it going, Doug?
It's going pretty well. It's going pretty well. How are you doing these days?
506 Consulting is really stoked to announce, I have to put this out there, to go into my musical realm just a bit. I'm now in the music promotion business, Doug, if you didn't know. Yeah, there's this really great band of musicians. They're kind of on a mini hiatus right now, and they're called Fuck Hawk. They're originally based out of Toronto, features one of my many, you know, maritime crew people, Matt Gay, who's kind of a scene legend, like a punk scene legend, you know, from really, when he hit Fredericton back in, the late 90s, early aughts, and the music scene in Atlantic Canada, if you follow guitar-based music whatsoever, has not been the same. And that's not even hyperbolic. So in terms of the musical representation stepping up, I just kind of figured Matt Gay and Fuck Hawk are underutilized musical assets. And so in the interests of raising, you know, appropriate talent to an appropriate level to the full extent that I'm able to with my minuscule middle-aged man teacher platform. Long live Fuck Hawk. Speaking as Matt Gay and Fuck Hawk's official artistic representation vis-a-vis 506 Consulting Limited. There. The promotion is out of the way. So, Doug, I repeat, you're doing well. I'm glad to hear this, pal. And if you want to, what are we even talking about today for the show?
That was a nice segue into what we're going to talk about today.
Fantastic.
I want to talk about professional teaching practice and where we came from. Because have you ever been stuck, like, in a bin? And it's like you've created the walls yourself and you're stuck in the room or you're in. And I've been looking at professional practice and looking at other people's practice. And it's like, why am I creating these walls? How did these walls get created? Because they're only in my mind, but they are solid. So watching you bust out of your walls, like with this whole, okay, I saw some of your social media posts about Matt Gay, did not know who he was, right? Like if he doesn't play a Celtic fiddle, I probably don't know.
The world needs more Matt Gay. You know, it's funny because I sort of expected like we were just going to do, to speak to the point, since you talked about my client under representation, I am going to say that really it was just going to be like, you know, the music series interview, such as we're doing kind of over here. And I just figured, okay, who do I know? Who's done some cool things? Literally just reaching out kind of semi-randomly. Matt Gay is one of my best friends. He's one of, like, literally, and just outside of all this, he's one of the top five people as a friend that I've ever had. And I haven't been in touch with him nearly enough lately. So he keeps a very, like, low, almost non-existent social media profile too. And, you know, I respect that, of course, but when he got back to me so quickly about, yeah, that'd be fun, let's just drink some beer and kind of have a talk about what he's been up to. And I really thought that was just going to be it. But then I sort of peeled back, you know, a little bit of what he's doing. And to my mind, there is a very legit artistic enterprise going on there in his accumulated work. And, you know, I'm talking to, you know, people who are into heavy music, you know, kind of a lot as my thing, part of it. And I can't see any of it that outstrips in any way just the really nasty Southern rock, Motorhead, Ramones, Nashville pussy, fucking heavy guitar rock that is done by people who have no other intention whatsoever than to rock out in the moment. And to that extent, I got to pay that respect. And so I was quite, you know, taken enough to kind of like, okay, I'm adding this to the semi-legit consulting. Whether he wants to or not, he hasn't disagreed. He hasn't told me no. So here we go. Matt Gay is my client, and I will be fielding all and any queries for artistic representation or services. So there, Doug. That's more of a promo than I meant to do, but you gave me the opportunity. So there.
Yeah. And I don't mean just that. When I'm talking about knocking down these walls of that we've created in our head or whatever bin we've happened to been slotted into, like, yeah. I look at what you've done with the EdTech conversation or EdNonTech conversations, right? Where yeah. you're reaching out and you're finding these people. And I wish I
highly
had more time.
Highly creative people. Yeah. Highly creative people. That's what my interest is. Just creativity that manifests. And I think that there's just something that we can all learn from that. And so hence, you know, kind of fitting into the purpose of this show as, again, a semi-legit educational venture, just in and of the content, right? To say yeah. nothing of the comments. We have new rounds of comments coming in from new cohort of TRU students. I haven't answered that nearly to the extent. I've replied to about four of them. So, you know, part of my out of 25 or 30 new comments within the past couple of weeks. So part of my deal this, you know, I was going to say this weekend, but folks, as a self-employed individual, I guess the weekend doesn't really matter in terms of barriers per se. So within the next day or two, I am going to get a bunch more of these replied to, because these are brilliant comments on the on the blog, right? This podcast goes. So yeah, that's cool. That's a cool aspect of it for sure, Doug. You're right.
And I know that I'm a person that gets stuck in the bin. I get stuck in the imaginary walls that I've created, and I'm watching you bust out, and it's like, cool. And then I thought, how did we get here? Because I need to analyze it. How did we get to creating these walls and creating these barriers? And I wanted to put it into the context of this podcast. And
Absolutely, it was, bro.
Good call. How do we get to the rules? How did this happen here with EdTech and here in education? So I dipped back into some literature, and I grabbed one. I learned so much this week about
is
a
this
guy
the one
that
from,
I...
Are you speaking now to the one from 1957 here, Krumbholz and Fokar?
The 58 one is the one that... The 1958 one is... Because, okay. Come on. If you don't know who B.F. Skinner is, right?
Oh,
you haven't
right.
done a lot of education stuff.
Get out of the city if you don't know who B.F. Skinner is.
I was so excited. I was so excited.
That, one of the original, you know, legit sort of thinkers in the education space that did a lot of really formative work in terms of, first of all, capturing empirical data, right? Because in the era, the mid-1950s, I mean, that just didn't exist yet within a body of, you know, actionable education literature anywhere near to the extent that it does now. So that's kind of a milestone in and of itself. But between him and, you know, oh Lord, I'm going to, anyway, it's ultimately led into what we now describe and utilize as the so-called constructionist and or constructivist, one sort of more European and product-based, one sort of more North American and process-based, but it's generally speaking the same stuff. So this is one of those things that goes back, you know, prior to even Freire, and you know, it's so good call on the Skinner, again, just for people who might be outside the educational area that Doug and I tend to work in, so.
Yeah, so I nerded out a bit, but I want to go to the Crumbolt and Farquhar 1957 article. It's about different teaching methods, because when we think about our teaching, what are we doing and how do we do it and what are the rules? And I've worked over time, I've worked with a lot of people that are not educators initially. They have skills in very specific disciplines, and then they end up teaching, right? And how many academics do we know that teaching is that add-on that they have to do for their job?
It's the tail that wags the dog for them, right? It's the case of, I'm really into all this other stuff, and teaching is just kind of whatever I have to do to keep the rest of it afloat, you know? So if you're looking at a, you know, research-oriented position at a public university in Canada, typically, I mean, if you're like, you know, especially if it's like a Canada research chair or something like that, you know, that relies on external funding, which is to say from directly from a provincial or federal, you know, research body, again, the context being Canada for that generally. And so it's just like, you know, they get like a 20% allotment of their teaching, right? As their, and everything else is research and service. Or, you know, for instance, maybe they just have to teach one class a year or two summer sessions, and then they spend the rest of the time focusing on what is properly their perception, properly the work of research and a lot of travel. A lot of people getting on airplanes and just destroying the environment with airplanes to go to in-person conferences again, because apparently we're so post-COVID that from what I can tell, again, I've been out of the loop for a while with this stuff, but people are getting on planes and they're getting their service and they're getting their, they get to travel business class and then they, you know, stay at the hotel for their 3 days and they get the nice catering and, you know, they get to pay, they get their $60 or $100 a day per diem. And it's just like, yeah, okay, awesome. Way to just kill the environment and throw resources at, well, something that ostensibly could happen through a web conference, you know, at, fractionally less investment in any of those other areas. But let's be real, I like business class travel as much as anybody. It's been a while if anyone wants to offer that to me and or Doug and Matt Gay and reps of five, other reps of 506 Consulting. Good Lord, I'm on a tangent, pal. Now, you please are. Tell me where we're going now.
So Crumbolt and Farquhar said there's three teaching methods that they observed in their research. And it's instructor-centered, student-centered, and eclectic. And I love the concept of eclectic because it's neither of the two. There's a parallel for me now because there's, in research, there's quantitative research, there's qualitative research, and then there's mixed methods. So these two did that back in 1957.
It's pretty like, far ahead of the curve, people. That's pretty good, yeah.
Or we're just so far behind the damn curve. Right? Like we're just recycling the same ideas and, oh, look, isn't that new?
Well, the fundamentals of education as we know it go back to really Aristotle and Plato, really, within the Western paradigm. You know, anything that's of value that sort of has emerged as educational practice is really, you know, from the Socratic dialogue, right? It's like not knowing, wanting to know, taking your method from obvious self-evident, as self-evident as they can be, principles, and then everything has to be like a logical flow from there. So that's where mathematics, ultimately, because it relies entirely on abstraction for its, you know, principles, is in fact, you know, it started out, Pythagoras and all that, others who I don't, a philosophical enterprise. And everything that stems from math, as we know it, is, you know, attached to that. So anyway, it's just it's interesting to me to think of, like, because the human condition hasn't really changed that much over thousands of years, really.
No.
since we sort of achieved biological stability with this latest tweak of evolution, which sort of puts the higher level, you know, thinking at the front end of it with the reptilian stuff there, but latent. So anyway, bro, traditional teaching methods arguably go back quite a ways.
I was just reading an article about Pythagoras and Pythagoras's theorem, and they have found evidence of that from 1500 years before Pythagoras was born. It's just, he had the right PR. All right. They labeled it Pythagoras's theorem. So it's his, even though it existed long before he was there.
It could have been invented by a woman. You know, it could have been invented by a slave. It could have been invented by somebody in some misbegotten island colony somewhere. But I mean, how many, it's sort of like when the printing press was going to go, right? It was going to be, you know, Gutenberg is the name that rings. Gutenberg ultimately gets, you know, but all the parallel side experiments, stuff that didn't even make it. I mean, that's why, I mean, the whole attribution of like, well, I discovered something. It's like, nah, something was already there, ready to be found. And again, whoever brings it to the public consciousness is really the person that fairly or unfairly gets the credit. So, yeah, very much of that, sir. Thank you.
Yeah, and that's part of the investigation of, we don't know how far we've come if we don't know where we started.
Correct.
And where we've actually come from. So it's having that look back exploration is what I'm finding interesting. Because, like, even when you're talking about discovery, it's like, yeah, if I walk into your house and it's like, oh, look at this, these records, I've discovered these, I'm taking them home, right? That's not what discovery actually is.
Finders keepers, that's what I say.
Yeah, that's not a good way to do so many things.
And yet,
yeah.
The human condition is limited to some pretty predictable variants. Altruism, not necessarily one of them.
No, it definitely doesn't get the press. It doesn't get stuff named after yourself.
Not even a bit. So in that instance, sir, are we ready to move on to our next reference as part of this? Skinner 1958. Skinner FTW is what we mean. Yes, sirree. Tell us about what we got with this one, sir.
Okay, there's two different components to this one. This is called Teaching Machines from Experimental Study of Learning Comes Devices. And because we're the Ed Non-Tech, and they said, learning machine? Perfect. Let's throw that sucker in.
Wow. That invites a lot of really bizarre and not necessarily helpful H5P interactions when I start thinking about what that could entail. Some of them involving the band Fuckhawk, actually. H5P rendering of Fuckhawk. Wow. Not helpful, but still, it's the Ed Non-Tech show. So.
And that's what creativity is, right? Precisely. We go down different avenues, and whatever works, works. And if it doesn't work, it's like, okay, we learned. Didn't work this time. Maybe next time. And one thing Skinner's talking about, the first thing Skinner's talking about, he says, in every field, people find efficiencies. They just do, right? I am inherently lazy. I will find the efficient way to do something. I fall in every ditch, but I don't fall in the same ditch twice, right? Like it's that kind of way. And has education really become efficient? Where's the labor saving? Where's the investment of capital and equipment to make it easier, to make it more efficient so that we can get to where we're trying to get to? And he talking about, we can't just build more buildings, right? We can't put more desks in. That's not what efficiency is. It's about, how do we make the teachers better teachers to get to where we need to? How do we find the efficiency in teaching? And I really, really enjoyed that.
Awesome.
Because we're still doing that.
Very much so.
But the problem with Skinner is, one of the problems with Skinner is, when I did my BED and even my master's and stuff, oh, no, Skinner didn't have it right. Oh, no, he was a behaviorist. Skinner's this and that. We've moved past his ideas. And so people really aren't digging in.
To speak to that point, I think you're quite right. I was thinking of the behaviorist rep as you were kind of talking. And I was also then circling back in my mind to what I said earlier about it sort of being a precursor to constructivism as we know it, even though it does fall under quite different principles. What I would just say is I'd kind of go back to the earlier remark I made that that study and other studies similar to that were breaking ground in the educational field in ways that hadn't been done before. So whether you're saying that he operated from like a sort of flawed philosophical base, it isn't really the point because he was doing something in the absence of other people doing something in that area. And then it invites you to look at the position and go, okay, this is something I don't agree with. What would it look like if I were to sort of take the good parts of this or, you know, and then change it or recontextualize it? And so it invites, you know, evolution, variation, right? From among, yes, you know, a rough kind of seed that's been kind of jammed in the soil vis-a-vis Skinner. So,
yeah. Yeah. I'm with you. It's hindsight's 2020. It's, I mentioned in another podcast ages ago about the fractal random walk of ants.
Oh my God, you did. I remember that.
Yes. So it's ants don't know where the food is. Ants don't know where they're trying to get, but ants are looking for something. And the way they pattern their search helps them find it. And then once they find it, bang, they're there. And it's the opposite of whales. Whales already know where the food is. Right? Whales know where the food is. They're not doing anything random and fractal. They're headed to the food. And that's the difference. Like he didn't have the good press now because he was doing the fractal random walk to try to figure it out. And like every time you hear press about B.F. Skinner, right? How much positive stuff are you hearing? It's like, oh, we got that wrong. Oh, we got that wrong. Man, if somebody walked around following me, the amount of stuff I get wrong because I'm exploring. That's what research is. That's what creating new is that.
I got 99 things wrong. 99. I'm trying to make a JZ metaphor. Anyway, 99 things wrong, one thing right. 50 years later, we see the one thing that he got right. And do you know what? All those other things were of the same cloth, and one thing caught on. I mean, you can't control how a public is going to respond to anything. I mean, right. It's like, you know, that stoic notion, right? As from Meditations and Marc Aurelius and everything, it's like you do everything within your control. You acknowledge what is outside of your control as being outside of your control. So it's like Van Gogh. I mean, what the hell? Yeah. That guy had a miserable life. And then a time came that they were ready and it didn't coincide with when he was alive, regrettably. You know, so it's like with Skinner, it's like all this stuff that was like, you know, our culture decided that this kind of one thing or whatever was of value. It was still part of the same cloth. You have to look at these things holistically. Otherwise you're missing pretty much everything to do with actual context. So that's my rant there, pal.
But how much does that happen in education?
Never. Not nearly enough.
That's why I'm doing the look back, because
good call.
I set the imaginary walls up and
sure.
And I listened to an article. There was a guy, Matt Damon, the actor.
Yes.
And he made a comment about working with other people, and the comment was about, don't judge me by my bad ideas, judge me by my great ideas.
There you go.
Right? It's like, let's take the good ones and run with it, and the bad ones, hey, they're bad. Okay. Didn't work. Move on.
Right. But,
and when we come to our professional practices, whatever they happen to be, are we doing that? Or are we like, nope, this is the way it is. This is how we move forward because this is how we've always moved forward. This is the way things are done. And that drives me bonkers. But,
well, and I think that speaks to our ongoing support of teaching centers, because a lot of our audience and a lot of what the show is about really kind of resides in the post-secondary world. And so, I mean, teaching centers have really only kind of taken off as a movement. I mean, I know that there have been isolated, significant experiments since the 60s. But I mean, you know, the movement coupled a lot with the notion of, for instance, SOTL, Scholarship of Teaching and Learning Literature,
yep,
notions of like action research, wherein you know, for people who are perhaps in limited appoint term appointments and whatever, can still do classroom research and hopefully get a paper or something out of it to further their careers. All of this, you know, is only really that I can tell has really come about since mid 1990s, you know, late 90s, early aughts, in terms of having established teaching centers with these practices, with these spots where you can kind of, you know, go for help in a teaching approach or whatnot. And so I think if we're talking about the history of the field, we're talking pretty recent innovations here. We're talking like within one worker's lifetime, really. It's not even within one full generational shift from the field of education since that kind of stuff started taking off.
So, and that's why I think the investigation is important, because look at how much things have changed. But look at how much things haven't changed as well, right? Like, it's the dichotomy of those two different things.
Very much.
Now, one thing that I really didn't know before, I went down a rabbit hole with these notes, because I read Skinner's article, and then he's talking about Sidney Pressey from the 1920s and designing learning machines. And this was new to me. And I like to read. And later in the notes, if people go to the website, the analogtrope.com/podcast, there's a picture of one of Pressey's learning machines.
Oh, boy.
And so this is, that is the earliest example of what I think people would really consider EdTech. Right? Because I think it's chalk and slate. I think it's pencil and paper. That's what I think. Or even whatever, radio or something. But this is 100% designed for learning first. And it didn't have to get adapted from where mass media. It didn't have to get adapted from any other industries. This was the first one that I can find. And oh, did I do this rabbit hole was tough for me to dig out of.
Because
it was so cool. Well, to me, it was cool to me. Some other people might.
I can tell you you're passionate about this, Doug. And I think given our strong support and propensity on this show for also ran formats, things that just didn't take off. You know, you'd be talking educational Betamax. You could be talking, educational telegraph tapping, right? Educational Morse code. As a medium or whatnot. Walkie-talkies, tin cans to the ear with a really long string. I do like this notion of, like, it's a very cool thing. It's like they weren't trying to make a new radio. They weren't trying to make a new cigarette machine. They weren't trying to make a better way to package Coca-Cola. It was, like, specifically for an educational purpose. Some years ahead of Moodle, I might even say. Good Lord. The original OG LMS right there. No digital required. Good Lord.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, man. So, I love it. So, I love that visual. Do we have any more references we want to get to before we start talking about the rest of the visuals?
Yeah. We got a couple more. So happy with it. So Pressey's machine was basically how to automate multiple choice questions. That's basically what it was.
Cool.
And it didn't work because society wasn't ready. Education wasn't ready. There was the cultural inertia. Didn't work.
Cultural inertia, dude. I think we might have the phrase of the podcast right there. I am digging that phrase. Just FYI. Yeah.
I really enjoyed it. So
I'm impressed how committed you are to going into this particular topic, bro. Because it's like you're always committed. I mean, you're always doing a professional job with these notes.
Sometimes I should be committed.
Well, I am clearly the most committable element of the show, bro. I mean, let's be real. However, incarcerating. God help us all. Anyhow, especially me, especially my kids. Good Lord. Rabbit holes. You got them. And I'm impressed that you went full rabbit hole on this particular topic, pal, is what I'm trying to say.
Thanks.
Yeah, man.
So I'm going to leave Skinner there and leave Pressey there. But I was just so excited to see this new thing that, like, I heard reference to it once or twice, but never dug into it. And then I dug in and it's like, oh, I'm so happy to have the skills and the available time to dig in and see what it is. So I want to jump to Hatch and Bennett in 1960. So only 2 years later, and they're talking about effectiveness in teaching. And in 1960, they're saying teaching effectiveness today is a national concern in the United States.
Good.
It's because there is the top priority they had was a mounting shortage of excellent teachers.
Because they don't pay teachers shit for money in the United States. I'm sorry, my American colleagues, but this is one major difference between the Canadian and the American context. If you are a K-12 teacher and you have a teacher's license and you put in like more than 5 years as a regular teacher, which somewhere in Canada, you know, under a, you know, provincially funded K-12 education system, you will be making, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 70 to 100 grand a year, depending on what you bring to the situation, which is, you know, enough in this country to have a pretty okay middle class standard of life pretty much anywhere in Canada outside Toronto or Vancouver, arguably. So that being said, what I understand the American system is you can put in your years, you can get tenure at your K-12 school, whatever. You're making scraps. You're making like, you know, 50, 60, 70 grand if you're lucky. And you're working hours that will burn you out and kill you. And so that's why, you know, it's like clearly, this is why this would be an issue, right? You don't know people entering the field. Like, get the fuck out. You're not paying them any money. You're not giving them any status. You let they can go to Norway, learn Norwegian, and get paid like a fucking medical doctor for the amount of like same amount, less effort than it would take to do. And anyway, bro, I'm just. You know it and I know it, but the people listening to the show maybe don't. So
right.
Okay.
So the second half of the Hatch and Bennett article that I really liked is they start talking about preparation.
Yep.
Like, so the instructional design component that is now across most of post-secondary. It's like teaching a large class through television is more demanding than teaching a small class. We both have experience developing material for online and distance learning.
Yep.
And you can't just walk into a classroom and wing it and just manage that stuff or, oh, yeah, do page 82.
So again, for the inexperienced or less experienced, I mean, I'm sitting here. I'm wearing a punk rock T-shirt. I post a video hyping my friend's band, Buck Hawk. I mean, I do a lot of these kind of like what I don't call them questionable. But if you're looking at it from the outside, you go, huh, this guy kind of takes a kind of ad hoc approach to his presentation on social media. But the reason I can do that and the reason I can walk into a classroom in person and sort of be conversational and kind of, you know, kind of open things up is because I've been doing this for so long in so many different ways. And that, you know, as Doug mentions, if you have training, if you have knowledge of your area, then, you know, and you know what to do to prepare effectively before you get into that situation, that is what will give you the confidence to sort of be, you know, yourself, you know, to have more of a social presence, because social presence is sort of, you know, vis-a-vis the community inquiry model, which I did my doctoral stuff on. It's sort of like it's what leads the charge in terms of like being able to bring in community engagement. And then as the basis for that, you can then build into your cognitive domain, and you can bring into your teaching domain. But, you know, you got to have like a reasonable level of comfort in the room before that can even happen. So whether your room is in person or virtually or what, Doug and I both have significant experience in this area. So, I mean, again, just folks, I'm more than just a rambunctious Instagram. Okay. I don't know why I need to say that, but I do. So anyway, bro, back to you.
No problem. So with the investigation into why we do what we do,
yep,
right? Like we have those skills and we've honed those skills and I've been eaten alive in those classes, right? Like I've had the 10-year-olds smell blood in the water and eat me alive.
And they're shackles. They're just like, I don't give a fuck and there's nothing you can do about it. And like,
yeah,
that was my first six, that was my first 6 or 7 months in Korea teaching kids who just, you know, it's like, fuck, you know, I thought I was going mental at a certain point, but then because of my colleagues because, you know, more experienced and getting a better sense of just what I could do in the situation. And I mentioned this on the show before, having a worksheet and having the kids doing something during the class together was like a revelation. It went from being eaten fucking alive to having, like, you know, a structured activity, just because the worksheet itself provided a structure. Like, okay, dudes, we're going to take 5 minutes. You're going to draw the picture. You're going to come up with a topic. Then we're going to share about it. Then, you know, this kid who's got an English name, even though they're Korean for the purposes of this class, you're going to, you know, write, you know, you're going to write your sentence, and then we're going to, you know, talk about it. And it was like, but you can't do the social stuff unless you got the material preparation in place. That was my major insight. And that's what I think you're speaking to there, pal.
That's a lot of what I'm speaking to. Yeah. And the time, like in 1960, like, I know some teachers that have said, you out, right? You're lipping off. You're out. You're gone.
That's right.
I don't care where you go.
That was your grandfather, right? That was you use that. That was his approach to rowdiness back in the day when he was a teacher. Because Doug's grandfather was a teacher. And Doug's dad was a teacher, and Doug is a teacher. So he's the third in a line of teachers in his family, folks. This is not trivial stuff. This is like, you know, there's like families of firefighters. There's family of, you know, military people. We got Dr. Doug in the house, and he is repping his third generational educator family. So not to be undermined or missed, my friend.
And my mom was a teacher.
You're goddamn right your mom was a teacher.
I have aunt and uncles that were teachers. So, yeah, I was born into this. But imagine going to post-secondary and not having the skills we have, not having the experiences with that. What's the easiest thing to do? The easiest thing to do is lecture and talk at people. Right?
Yeah. And then it's their fault. And then it's their problem if they don't understand what the fuck you're talking about.
Exactly. Yeah, so that's
like, that's your problem. That's a you problem, not a me problem, even though I'm the one doing the talking up here. Yeah, right. I know.
So it's all of this. So as I was digging into why is this happening? It's like, oh yeah, okay, that's why. That's why. Right. And the next one is Lanyard, or Laidlaw and Lanyard, 1947. Yeah. And this is because we talked to Tony Bates. That you set up. So thank you again for setting that up.
Wasn't that fun? Didn't you enjoy that, Doug? I was so glad you were able to be there, man, because that was
amazing.
So thank you for being part of that, bro.
That was one of the highlights of my year.
For like, sure, me too.
Half over.
Hands down. Other than with Matt Gay, but this is where I'm gonna take the opportunity to differentiate the podcast. And I'm gonna say Tony Bates has for sure been the highlight for sure, of these interviews, on the education side. And then on the music side, I'm repping my man, Matt Gay. I'm repping him as his official, artistic representation. That's how it's going over there. Definitely my favorite interview so far. And also repping the Fuck Hawk. Long live Fuck Hawk. Anyway, bro, sorry. Just had to throw in the promo. It's been a while. You're mute. You're mute.
That was no problem.
That's okay. It's the Maritimes. This has happened. Okay, so we're now back from our Camtasia edit point. Can't wait to see what we're going to do with that. I'll do my best not to put in graphics from Fuck Hawk into that interlude, but no guarantees, no promises or guarantees. Let's just jump sort of at an arbitrary point back into the notes, Doug, if we may. Were we still speaking about Hatch and Bennett, or are we on to Laidlaw and Lanyard?
Laidlaw and Lanyard, 1970.
Yes, there we go. Thank you, sir.
And what I really liked about these people before I got so rudely interrupted by living in the Maritimes, you know, in the Maritimes, people just come by and just stop at your house.
And they just jaw at you like you're supposed to be glad to see them and just talk to them about their lives and the weather. A lot of the weather. Yeah. God, the gall. The gall, I tell you. The exactly. Chutzpah. No kidding, bro.
It's so nice to have a good life and have people that are I'll do that.
Close to you, but at the ready. You're goddamn right. I think we can all agree. Yes, sir.
So this OU article, what I really liked is they were digging into the Open University.
Yep.
And with Tony Bates being one of the people from back in the day at the Open University.
Early with the OU, too. Like, early.
Like, the first researcher ever, right? He did a couple of years of teaching in K-12 and then right to the OU. But
is that what his career was before? Was he in K-12? I didn't even know that.
Yeah,
see, that's,
yeah, I looked at his resume, and he had 3 years of that.
Nifty.
Which explained so much to me about
his
mindset.
The practical emphasis of his research outputs, the accessibility, jargon-free of the way that he writes. And everybody, I mean, again, not just talking punk rock and yada yada. I'm serious. If you haven't, if you're involved in the distance ed or e-learning or whatever in any way, or even have an interest about it, I would say our episode with Tony Bates, our interview from earlier last week, is a really good starting point. Because what I appreciate about Tony's work, one of the many things, is that, you know, jargon-free, meant for practical usage, updated frequently, using only material that's been vetted by, you know, not just academics with him, but like practitioners, teachers, you know, people who are involved in the administration side of things. He really, all these influencers and sort of people who have a hand on what education even looks like, you know, Tony brings it together in a way that's practical, realistic, forward-looking. And his blog, TonyHD.ca, is just legitimate. It goes back years, tons of resources, including speaking to his time at Contact North, Ontario's kind of main e-learning sort of bodies. You know, just it's absolutely stellar in every way. And I think, as you say, Doug, good 2 or 3 years as a classroom teacher in K-12 really is formative. I mean, I still refer to my B.Ed. training, you know, decades later at this point, almost, is just being so important, even though I haven't done almost any K-12 teaching since I got it, right? If any. So anyway, man, totally appreciate where you're going with that one.
So what they've done is, as we investigate where we're coming from and what we're doing, they broke down their teaching system into four main components, like correspondence materials, because it was before online, right? This was a correspondence school. They did TV and radio broadcasts as well, and they had that tied into the BBC. So it was educational programming that the BBC was putting out. It was some face-to-face teaching. And then the fourth thing was home experimental kits and student computing services.
Oh.
And if you take a look, like, how many home experimental kits exist now? Like, is that something that made the leap into the online?
I have a very specific memory of that, and that I was in about grade 3, grade 4, grade 5, somewhere in there, one of those 3 years. And like, we're talking late 80s. Okay.
Yeah.
And as a Christmas gift, I think one of those years under the tree, you know, it was one of those experiment kits, probably ordered from the Sears catalog, which no longer exists, RIP. And my best friend John Bowie came over for like a, you know, overnighter stay, you know, at that point, dude I'm still friends with to this day. And I remember we opened it up and we kind of stayed up throughout the night just trying to make something cool with it. And we're just like, what the fuck is this? Like, we wanted to make like a potion. We had no interest in science. We had no interest. Once we realized it wasn't going to make my hand change color or create a cloud of smoke, I'm like, we got about 2 or 3 hours use of it, and then just like, never touching that again. That was kind of a drag. I mean, you know, John, if you're listening, you can correct me if I'm wrong. That's kind of how that went down. Yeah, home experiment kits did not make the leap.
No, they but it's interesting because in 1974, that was a key component. That was a major push, and for examples like what you just shared, didn't move forward with that, right? Do the cost-benefit analysis. The students weren't learning, they weren't interested, move on.
and also RAN format. We should come up with a home experimentation kit for the Ed Nontek show. I don't even know what that would include. Like an ashtray, you know, half a vegan lager. God, possibilities are endless. Folks, the Ed Nontek podcast and 506 Consulting Limited are your supply store for home experimentation kits of varying sizes and varying quantities. Please be sure to email 506consultingnb@gmail.com for more information. I'm thinking like, got to think in the promotional aspects of this stuff, man. Got to get an entrepreneurial mindset.
Yes. Now, the last one is a 2016 article, so I jumped 50-odd years ahead. And these, I do not even want to try to challenge these names for this title. It's a Neurotitnovina.
And Perchaquino.
Yes.
And it wouldn't be et al. We can say et al. We can say et al. There's four authors, so we can say Neurodivinova et al. There we go.
Yes. And Youth. I apologize for not being able to pronounce those names.
Same. He's more apologetic, but I'm almost as apologetic. He's nicer than me and better informed.
And they were talking about innovative teaching practices, tradition and long-term learning methods, and challenges and implications. So that's a very modern title compared to some of the other stuff we looked at today.
Yep.
But they dug into Suggestopedia.
I love that word. Oh, my God. That's too. A brilliant word. New word alert, Suggestopedia. I think we're going to have to add a category on the show strictly for that. That is brilliant.
Oh,
sorry, we mangled your names, dudes, but that's a brilliant word.
That's right. So it's one of those things. So it's a theory about applied positive suggestions in teaching.
Ooh, I like that.
And I really liked it. And then there's a history of where it's coming from, and there's like the Greek derivations and stuff. But it was a distinctive feature of this method is the disclosure of memory reserves and raising intellectual activity and the uses of suggestion and relaxation. And so all of this was coming out of the 1970s.
Nifty.
And I think some of this is some of the founding material that people explore when they talk about play in education.
Fair enough.
And some constructivism, because it's like, so how did you get that? Like, did you think about doing this and let people go explore that other thing, right? Instead of telling them and being directive, well, did you think about and coming up with those suggestions? But I just love the concept that this is a scientific word. And it's digging in a way that I don't think ed tech or ed philosophy digs in enough. Or if they do, it's not mainstream.
That's brilliant. I appreciate, you know, the things that you are disclosing that you admire about this at the conceptual level. I would say that ed tech is kind of bound as a field, regrettably so, to the fact that it tends to be, you know, it gets its existing capital expenditure, right? It gets its existence from budget lines that are mandated and approved in the first instance by academic institutions with, you know, the non-professor cohort or non-teacher cohort, you know, they're the last ones to get it. So any commentary that comes from the education field necessarily relies on these infrastructure investments that they have no control over, you know, largely. So to that effect, it can't be, you know, a field which deals with primary instances, which some people could say is sort of a deficiency to it. So I guess I really appreciate what you've described this as being, you know, sort of self-contained. It doesn't need much in terms of other reference points in order to have applicability to the situation.
Yeah. And I just loved the word. I loved Suggestopedia because I read it and I'm like, oh, what is that? And that's why, so for listeners, if you go to the website, there's a whole like derivation in, like normally I try to keep my direct quotes short, but this is a whole list of here's where it came from, here's where you can go find them or read about it, and here's a bunch of different spellings. It was just one of those things that's like, yeah, here's where we're coming from. Because that's still 50-odd years ago. I'd never seen that term before. I've been in this field my whole life. We both have terminal degrees. I've never seen that. And that's something I would dig around and look at.
Well, again, it's kind of one of the cool things about attaching yourself to an intellectual endeavor over the longer term. I mean, no matter how much you think you know, there's always something cool about it. And, you know, I would use the analogy of like a lifelong sports fan who's, you know, always trying to find ways to find efficiencies in their game. Or, you know, for me, somebody who's like a lifelong fan of punk and alternative music. I mean, I get thrilled when I find, you know, some obscure release that only came out on, you know, limited run, you know, didn't get any recognition in its day. They only put out one EP or whatever. And it's like, God, this is rad. I mean, this is the stuff that makes me stoked for it. So, you know, it's, again, finding nuggets in the literature or whatever that, you know, that are just new and brand new to you, even if they've been around for a while, is it's just one of the cool things about being part of a field over a longer term, right? So.
And this creative endeavor gives us the freedom to explore that.
And quite right.
I wouldn't have. There is no way in the world that if I was doing my job and living my life and planting and walking my dogs, I'm going to the literature to explore this
stuff. You have just described an awesome life, though. You have just described what a lot of people would consider as an awesome life in and of itself. So I remain grateful and appreciative that you see the value of this in other ways. And so are willing to kind of keep going as an ongoing partnership for this thing. You know, it's really quite significant to me that you've invested as much in this as you have, Doug.
Well, thank you, because I couldn't have done it without you. I wouldn't have done it without you. That's
I got it. I'm like, sure. You know, for sure.
Yeah. But this feeds part of my soul.
Good. I'm glad. Everybody needs that some way, I think. Yeah. Otherwise, you get stagnant. You get culturally inert. That's the phrase, right? Culturally inert. No? Okay.
Cultural inertia.
So there we go. There we go. Okay. So what else do we like about this article, or are we ready to move on to the next one, bro?
The biggest thing is what it opened up and what it represented to me. And I do a lot of suggesting. I do when I talk to people, hey, did you think about or what about? And people come to me for that.
Yep.
Because they know I think differently and I look at it differently.
They know I bring a unique vantage point to the situation.
Yes.
I've been getting that a little bit in my life, bro. I'm not going to lie. You may be surprised. I hear you. Yeah.
I am not that surprised.
Dude doesn't really think like the rest of us. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. It's a hard life. It's a rad life, but it can be hard.
Well, we've had that conversation too, where I wouldn't want anybody to follow the path I've taken.
It's kind of an ongoing theme, if you will, book publishers who are looking to monetize the content on this blog that we would be happy to explore vis-a-vis nb@gmail.com.
Thanks for adding the NB to that address. That's cool.
You're right.
We learned that.
NB, no pro bono. It's not just New Brunswick, no pro bono. Note well, right? When you see the annotation in a academic, that's actually a thing. It's like NB, like Latin. Notro bono, note well. I think that's what. Notra something. Anyway. So that's why it's legit. I'm not just hyping my pathetic Atlantic Canadian punk enterprises, okay, which are admittedly rad. But nah, NB. It's like notro bono or whatever the fuck.
I didn't know that. That's cool. Thank you for letting me know.
We both are learning things on this very show, bud. Every time we do one of these, I walk away with like three kind of low-key aspects of information. I'm like, I didn't fucking know that before. I wouldn't have known that if I hadn't talked to Doug today. It's, again, part of the ongoing enjoyment of the creative endeavor. So
what I have now is a couple of random pictures from my digital clutter. And one is Pressy's teaching machine, and the link is there in the notes, so if you want to go and learn more about it.
I may get that thing tattooed. I mean, I might have space for that. That's a pretty cool visual. So,
and there's a couple of other things that made me giggle. And one of them is this picture of a river flowing, right? And it's just a river. And, you know, it's pretty. There's trees around it and rocks and stuff. And then there's a picture of a beaver. And it's like, I'm going to put a stop to this nonsense immediately. And that's how... beaver. Yeah. And I like beavers, right? Big fan of beavers. And
who doesn't like themselves a good beaver?
Yeah.
Nobody. That's who.
But beavers are single-minded.
We right? love beaver on this show. We are beaver-loving people on this show. And they are single-minded.
They single-minded. Are. I'm trying to be less single-minded. This is part of getting rid of the
I would much rather be less single than I am. Good Lord.
Oh, I didn't mean that. You go down that tangent all you want.
I'm getting silly, bro. It's getting towards the end of the show. I got to get my like giggles out.
And that's it. There's only one other picture I want to talk about. And I know, because you're a music person, you will like the, would you believe, 13 records or tapes for $1.
That was how my music collecting era got started, quite frankly.
Yes.
My mom was just like, this looks like something you'd be interested in. And I guess probably the collection agency's after my mom now, because I never bought the rest of them.
Oh, you're sorry, the reason it stopped. So, okay.
I'm sorry. You know.
But it's part of one of these things that it breaks down barriers. It's like, who can get 13 records for a dollar back in 1980, whatever, right? That or 1990, whatever. That can't happen. And it opened up so many things for so many people, but the model wasn't sustainable.
Nope.
It just wasn't. And now it couldn't possibly exist because YouTube and the internet have happened. But it's one of those things is let's break down the barriers, explore what we're doing, and where does that lead us? It was those kinds of random things that I just loved, and they all tied into my idea of exploring where we're from and what we're doing and why are we doing it. And if just because we've always done it that way, that's not good enough. That's not correct. A good enough reason.
Absolutely friggin' not.
So what I've got now is three more things, the word, question, and phrase of the podcast.
Awesome. What are they?
Word of the podcast is tradition, because that seems to be so many people just do it because that's tradition. That's how this gets done. This is the way it works. Question of the podcast, is tradition just peer pressure from dead people?
Fucking A. That is a great question, Doug. I like that question a lot. Come on. Yeah, man.
Thanks. Oh, I absolutely ripped it off of somebody else, but I don't remember who, so I couldn't attribute it to them. But that's what it is.
Cultural knowledge, folks. That's how the Bible got started. Cultural knowledge.
Yeah. And the phrase of the podcast is cultural inertia. This was good enough. This was fine. That's like
evidence of just good enoughism is everywhere about us. You know, it's like a plague. Like, this is adequate. You don't have to do more than just friggin' go to work, watch TV, couple shit, and consume. Like, okay, whatever. Like, yeah, man. Evidence of it abounds. That's a good one. It
really does.
Yeah.
But that's all I've got. So what are you thinking?
I've enjoyed the show a lot, as always. I've already figured out the song that we're going to use for this, which is a punk track by a Florida-based band that I really like called Ship Thieves, and it's called Born Into This. And one of the reasons that's cool, apart from the fact that I actually have a Ship Thieves tattoo, and also that it's just a really killer song on a really killer record, is that it's by Charles Bukowski, who is a pretty well-known American poet and writer, kind of poet laureate of the American lowlife is sort of his claim to fame. Highly prolific, didn't get published or recognized in his writing career until his late 40s, and just, you know, kind of known as being a rampant, unapologetic alcoholic and writing about it in pretty graphic, you know, plain-spoken terms, but in the tradition of other plain-spoken American stylists such as William Carlos Williams, you know, of Patterson and sort of, you know, the American vernacular, medical doctor from New Jersey, you know, it's got sort of the similar grain to it, if you will, as Bukowski has in his sort of Los Angeles Flophouse, you know, some 50, 60 years later. I know both the eras and I can speak to both the eras, and I think it's of the same cloth. So, you know, I'm just sort of thinking forward now to what the production element of this show is going to look like, because that's going to be fun, you know, putting that together, and also how it relates a bit to the last conversation that I had, which you have to check out, Doug, as well as anybody else, with Stephen Downs, major researcher in the e-learning space for decades, works for the government of Canada, doing some very important research, travels all over the place, you know, speaking, keynote, and participating in just completely innovative, dynamic approaches. He's one of the founding people of connectivism, one of the major thinkers of connectivism. He was sort of associated with the MOOCs, the open education movement, yep, some years back. And he's really, his latest thing that he disclosed to me, Doug, that I didn't know, which I think he was really coming out on our show, which you'll see in, later today, in favor of open educational resources, OER, which, cool. I mean, you and me are just totally stoked on, yeah, OER throughout the beginning of the show. So to hear him say that, was really like, huh, I am legitimately impressed. So I guess, Doug, thanks for the opportunity to kind of close things out with what's on my mind. You know, that's kind of the thrust of the remainder of my Sunday and Monday. Let's put it that way.
Right on. And I'm disappointed I didn't get to talk to Stephen Downs, but it's just
the way it's totally rad. We have some more cool guests, I have to say, coming up as early as next week for the education show. So I'll be sure to loop you in where is possible, Doug. Okay?
Fantastic.
Radical. Well, I've enjoyed this. I'm ready to end the recording if me Doug too. Is ready for the recording to be ended. It's been a virtual and veritable slice. Take care, everybody, and bye for now.
Bye-bye.